Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and may I say without delay, Happy Father's Day. Dad, you just don't get celebrated as you should. When I consulted my trusty book of famous quotes, there was not one listing for fathers. There were 3 full pages of quotes about mothers. And what about classic Dad's Day gifts? Ties, belts, polo shirts? These aren't gifts with sentiment. I'm here to help with great gift ideas. We'll be previewing an entertaining array of books Dad will love. And there's a common thread running through this group. The hero is the strong, silent type. Isn't that a fitting tribute for Dad? My guest today, Craig Johnson, has a new title in the Sheriff Walt Longmire series. Oh, Walt is a fabulous lawman and an incredibly loving father. Let's begin our Dad's Day salute now as we turn to page 1 of the book report. Fans of Preston and Child's Pendergast series will enjoy Lincoln Child's new thriller, The Forgotten Room. Charismatic and quirky Professor Jeremy Logan is an enigmologist, an investigator who specializes in analyzing phenomena that have no obvious explanation. As the story begins, Logan finds himself in Newport, Rhode Island. He's been retained by Lux, one of the oldest and most respected think tanks in America. Days earlier, a series of frightening events occurred in the organization's seaside mansion. One of its most distinguished doctors began acting erratically, violently attacking an assistant in the mansion's library, and moments later, killing himself. Terrified by this incident and the bizarre evidence left behind, the group hires Logan to investigate. His work leads him to an unexpected find in a long-dormant wing of the estate. Logan uncovers a hidden secret room, concealed and untouched for decades. The room is a time capsule, filled with eerie and obscure scientific equipment that points to a top-secret project long thought destroyed, known only as Project S. Ultimately, the truth of what Project S was and what happened in that room will put Logan in a path of completely unexpected danger. The book is performed by Jonathan McLean.
I quickly realized that proving the existence of the creature required only one thing, observing it in its element. Proving that the creature does not exist, however, would require a great deal more work. Technology would be my greatest ally. Hence, I persuaded the United States Navy, of which I was once a part, to lend me this one-man research submersible. And Logan waved at the strange-looking machine sitting on the wooden scaffold to his right. The submersible is equipped with continuous wave radar, synthetic aperture sonar, pulse compression echolocating devices, and numerous other technologies for both underwater mapping and target acquisition. There were 2 important factors to take into account. First, the lock is quite long and unusually deep, 750 feet in places. Second, so-called sightings of the creature suggested a morphology similar to a plesiosaur, which would put it at something between 20 and 40 feet in length. There were several unknown variables to contend with, of course, such as the creature's range of movement and environmental preferences, but these could not be determined until such time as it was located. I began by familiarizing myself with the features of the submersible and the layout of the lock, both above and below the surface. My service in the Navy made the former relatively straightforward. I spent 1 week in this shakedown period, during which time I uncovered no sign of the creature. Next, I had the Institute procure for me some netting, rather a lot of netting, in fact. Using spools of military-grade nylon mesh, we put together a net 10,000 feet by 800 feet. This brought murmurs of surprise. What came next was rather tedious, but after the first few run-throughs, quite straightforward. I was lucky in the fact that the lock, although some 20 miles long, is not particularly wide, just under 2 miles at its widest point. We started at the northernmost point of the lock and worked south. My work was aided by 2 research assistants from the Institute and 2 motor launches out of Inverness. Each day, using the submersible, I would comb an area of the lock consisting of a single mile in a southerly direction. a mile-long slice of the lock, as it were, along the X, Y, and Z axes. For each of these discrete slices, I would make three separate passes at different depths, using the submersible's movement and targeting technologies to search for any object the size of the creature. This equipment has significant range and precision. Had any object of the requisite size been in the slice, I would have located it. At the end of each day, with the help of the research assistants, one on each shore of the lock, and the two boats on the lock itself, I moved the netting 1 mile forward to the terminal point of my search for that day. This vast mesh covered the entire lock laterally, like an anti-submarine net. The mesh was broad enough for any normal fish to swim through without difficulty, but narrow enough to prevent anything larger than 40 centimeters wide from passing. Watercraft were dealt with on a one-by-one basis. Each day I explored an additional 1 mile slice of the lock, searching for the creature. At the end of each day, as mentioned, we pulled the net forward another mile. After 20 days, we reached the southern end of the lock without result. And so, ladies and gentlemen, you can take as fact the four words I'm about to speak, though I speak them with some regret, since I enjoy cryptozoological legends as much as the next man. There ain't no Nessie. This was greeted with applause, a scattering of laughter. A low sound became audible in the distance, a droning, repetitive thudding. As the sound drew closer, it became identifiable as helicopter blades cutting through the air. Then, a fat chopper with military markings appeared over a nearby hilltop lined with red brick row houses. It approached quickly now, an American Navy aircraft, then descended, hovering directly over the great lawn and the dark gray submersible.
That was a sampling of The Forgotten Room by Lincoln Child. Two-time Pulitzer Prize winner David McCullough returns to the bestseller list to tell the dramatic story of the brothers who taught the world to fly, Wilbur and Orville Wright. On December 17, 1903, at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, Wilbur and Orville's Wright Flyer became the first powered, heavier-than-air machine to achieve a controlled, sustained flight with a pilot aboard. The age of flight had begun. How did they do it? And why? Sons of an itinerant preacher and a mother who died young, Wilbur and Orville grew up on a small side street in Dayton, Ohio, in a house that lacked indoor plumbing and electricity. But it was filled with books and a love of learning. The brothers ran a bicycle shop that allowed them to earn enough money to pursue their mission in life, flight. In the 1890s, flying was beginning to advance beyond the glider stage, but there were major technical challenges. The brothers traveled to North Carolina's remote Outer Banks to test the plane they'd built. Why there? Because it had three indispensable conditions: constant wind, soft surfaces for landings, and privacy. The Wrights risked their lives every time they flew. Orville nearly died in a crash in 1908, but was nursed back to health by his sister, Catherine. Despite their achievements, the Wrights could not convince the U.S. government to take an interest in their plane until they demonstrated its success in France, where the government instantly understood its importance. Now, master historian David McCullough, who narrates, draws on nearly 1,000 letters of family correspondence, plus diaries, notebooks, and family scrapbooks to tell the full stories of the Wright brothers and their heroic achievements.
In as strong a photograph as any taken of the brothers together, they sit side by side on the back porch steps of the Wright family home on a small side street on the west end of Dayton, Ohio. The year was 1909, the peak of their fame. Wilbur was 42, Orville 38. Wilbur, with a long poker face, looks off to one side as though his mind were on other things, which most likely it was. He is lean, almost gaunt, long of nose and chin, clean-shaven and bald. He wears a plain dark suit and high-laced shoes, much in the manner of their preacher father. Orville gazes straight at the camera, one leg crossed nonchalantly over the other. He is a bit stouter and younger-looking than his brother, and has a touch more hair, in addition to a well-trimmed mustache. He wears a lighter-toned, noticeably better-tailored suit, snappy argyle socks, and wingtips. The argyles were about as far in the direction of frippery as any of the right men would ever go. Prominent, too, in the pose, appropriately, are the hands, the highly skilled hands that, by the time the picture was taken, had played a substantial part in bringing miraculous change to the world. To judge by the expressions on their faces, they had little, if any, sense of humor, which was hardly the case. Neither liked having his picture taken. Truth to tell, one reporter wrote, the camera is no friend either to the brothers. But what is most uncharacteristic about the pose is that they sit doing nothing, something they almost never succumb to. As others in Dayton knew, the two were remarkably self-contained, ever industrious, and virtually inseparable. Inseparable as twins, their father would say, and indispensable to each other. They lived in the same house, worked together 6 days a week, ate their meals together, kept their money in a joint bank account, even thought together, Wilbur said. Their eyes were the same gray-blue, though Orville's were less predominant and closer together. Their handwriting was quite alike, consistently straight and legible, and their voices so alike that someone hearing them from another room had trouble knowing which one was doing the talking. If Orville was always noticeably better dressed, Wilbur, at 5'10", stood an inch or so taller, and as would be said, more often in France than in Dayton, women found him somewhat mysterious and quite attractive. Both loved music. Wilbur played the harmonica, Orville the mandolin. At work, they sometimes found themselves spontaneously whistling or humming the same tune at the same time. Both were strongly attached to home. Both liked to cook. Biscuits and candy were Orville's specialties. Wilbur took pride in his gravy, and for the Thanksgiving or Christmas turkey, insisted on taking charge of the stuffing. Like the father and the sister Catherine, the brothers had tremendous energy, and working hard every day but Sunday was a way of life, and if not on the job, then at home on improvements. Hard work was a conviction, and they were at their best and happiest, working together on their own projects at the same waist-high bench, wearing shop aprons to protect their suits and ties. Everything considered, they got along well, each aware of what the other brought to the task at hand, each long familiar with the other's particular nature, and always with the unspoken understanding that Wilbur, the older by 4 years, was the senior member of the partnership, the big brother.
That was The Wright Brothers by David McCullough. Johnson is the best-selling author of the incredibly popular Walt Longmire mystery series. The books, 13 in all, have won multiple awards, including the Western Writers of America Spur Award for Fiction. And of course, the books are the inspiration for the popular A&E TV series, Longmire. Craig lives in U Cross, Wyoming, population 25. Today we'll speak with him about the newest title in his series, Dry Bones. Welcome, Craig. It's great to have you with us on the Book Report.
Well, please. Pleasure's all mine.
Well, 13 books ago, what made you pick up the pen and start writing?
You know what? It was one of those things where, you know, there are always two reasons why somebody becomes a writer. And the first one is you stumble across a story that you think needs to be told. And then the other one is you run out of excuses, because I'm firmly of the belief that everybody's got a writer inside them. The problem is they generally have an editor inside them who strangles them to death before they get anything written on paper. And so that was pretty much what I wanted to do. Like, the other thing was is that, you know, it was a time period when everything was all about CSI. Everything was all forensics, ballistics, all that type of stuff. And I talked to a DCI investigator in Wyoming and asked him, I said, how long does it take you guys to get DNA evidence? And he paused for a second. He says, is this a high-profile case? And I said, yeah. And he goes, let's say it is. And he said, about 9 months.
Oh.
And so it seemed to me that what they were doing, you know, with all the television shows and all the books and everything, it just was, really wasn't honest. And so I thought, well, what if you had the protagonist of your books be the, you know, sheriff of the least populated county in the least populated state in America? And that's how Walt Longmire began.
I see. Well, in Dry Bones' opening acknowledgments, you share how you became interested in dinosaur excavations in the American West. Can you tell our listeners that story?
Well, I'm not that much of an aficionado of dinosaurs, but I was actually happened to be overseas. I do a number of foreign tours. And every once in a while, my daughter and granddaughter kind of glom onto those trips. Like, and so I have a six-year-old attached to me most of the time. Like, and she's absolutely lovely. Like that. But we happened to be at the Museum of Natural History in London, and we went in like that, and they had a giant T-Rex there, like that, and you know, it was very impressive. Like, and I looked down and saw the plaque said that it was from Niobrara County, Wyoming. And so it made me kind of aware, and I started looking every time I went into a museum to see where the T-Rexes were from, and they always seemed to come from Wyoming. And so I contacted a paleontologist buddy of mine, and I said, what's the story on this? And he goes, oh, yeah, it's kind of a hotbed area, that northern Rockies, you know, Powder River region, like that, an awful lot of the, you know, the T-Rexes that you'll see in all the major museums around the world, you know, are from our area. And so I got thinking about it, and I remembered the story of Sue. I don't know if you recall, like it was the largest, most intact T-Rex ever found right across the border over in South Dakota. And it kind of turned into a big media sensation simply because the rancher whose property the T-Rex was found on attempted to sue the people who found it. Like that. And the problem was he was an Indian rancher, and then the tribe stepped in and said, you know what, it's actually all of ours. Like that. And that's when the federal government stepped in and said, you know what, it was actually on lease land, so actually it belongs to all of us. And so all I could think was, boy, does that sound like a Walt Longmire mystery novel.
I'll say, you know, I learned so much about dinosaurs reading your book. Like you said, the dinosaurs have walked the face of the earth for 165 million years, while human beings have only been around for 200,000 years. How much time did you spend researching before you started writing this book?
You know, that's one of the great things about being a writer is you can just lay there on the sofa and be, you know, reading, you know, and I tell my wife, don't bother me, I'm working here, you know, and, but it's fun because, I mean, that's one of the great things about the job is you get to go out and do the research on all the things you want to learn about, you know, and I was so curious about it, and, you know, I mean, I had a, you know, passing knowledge, but certainly not enough to write the book, so it was a learning experience for me, too, and then the other thing that was kind of shocking to me was to find out how many of these, you know, big scientists, you know, Marsh and Cope and the dinosaur wars that happened in Wyoming, like that, for the Peabody Museum at Yale, like that, and the Carnegie and all these others. Like, it was kind of interesting to find out that these guys, you know, hated each other and, you know, tried to sabotage each other's digs. And, you know, the anger between the two got to the simple point where one actually had, after the other one had died, had his skull on his desk. And you just don't think about that kind of, you know, petty activity between scientists. You would think that they were above that type of thing, but evidently not.
Well, introduce us to Dinosaur Jen, who is kind of the focal point of your book.
She is like that. She's kind of the counterpoint to Sue, like that. She's discovered, you know, in Walt County, there in Absaroka, like that, and it becomes, you know, an awful lot like the circus that happened, you know, with Sue. And, you know, of course, it involves, you know, the family that's, that happens to own the ranch, you know, where it takes place. And, you know, of course, my situation, my story and my take on this is a little bit different from the actuality, but it borrows an awful lot from the actual story that happened over there in the Hill City in South Dakota. But in my book, of course, it starts out with a little bit more drama in the sense that Walt and Vic get called out, you know, to this rancher's property, and there's a large reservoir there like that, and there's a fisherman standing there on the side of the reservoir, and he's got a handful of rocks that he's tossing into the water, and Vic's response is that some kind of weird Wyoming fishing technique that I don't know about? Walt says, well, I don't know, let's go find out. And he walks over and says, hey, Omar, what are you up to? Look at it. And he says, I'm trying to keep the snapping turtles off that body that's floating out there in the water. And, you know, it's a little bit more of a dramatic take on the whole thing to get the ball rolling. But that's actually a story that I got from a Wyoming sheriff, like that his grandfather was a sheriff, and they were going out fishing one morning, and he got a call like that, and they went and answered it, and he got his first introduction, I guess, to what sheriffing is all about.
Ah, so Absaroka County has a population of 2,483 citizens in 9,000 square miles. And your hometown, New Cross, Wyoming, has a population of 25. I'm guessing your hometown is the inspiration for Absaroka?
Well, about 30 miles down the road, there's a little town called Buffalo, Wyoming. And that's kind of the basis for Durand. And Absaroka County doesn't really exist. Like that, there are only 23 counties in Wyoming like that. But I took a clue, you know, from Faulkner and thought, you know what, maybe if I use, you know, a fictitious county, maybe this would be a good idea because it'll give me a little bit more creative freedom like that to write what it is that I want to write. And I'd have to answer, you know, all the documentary questions that a lot of people might have if I based it on an actual town and an actual county. So that's how the 24th county in Wyoming began.
We're speaking with Craig Johnson on the Book Report. Can you tell us about the evolution of Walt's relationship with Undersheriff Vic Moretti?
You know what? When I first started out the books, you know, you get a lot of advice from a lot of other authors, and one of the first things they said was you can have sexual tension between the characters, but you can't have anything happen. And, you know, at least for like, you know, 17 or 18 books or something. And I thought, okay, nothing's going to happen between these characters for 17 or 18 years. What kind of women are you dating anyway? It just didn't seem particularly honest or realistic. And so about the third book, you know, Kindness Goes Unpunished, I went ahead and had, you know, something happen, you know, between the two of them. Because it seemed to me that, you know, the lifeblood of a series of books is how you allow those characters to evolve and to change. You know, we've all started series of books, you know, that start out gangbusters, but then you get about seven or eight books in, and it seems like they're, you know, just, you know, repeating plot lines, and the characters don't seem to be developing or changing or having things happen to them in their lives that cause them to evolve. And so I thought, you know what the heck? All it's going to do is complicate their lives. I'm going to go ahead and have something happen. And it turns out to have been the case.
Talk about Henry Standing Bear. I bet most of your fans think he's one of the best characters of the West.
Henry is the Northern Cheyenne bar owner of the Red Pony Bar and Grill, you know, named for Steinbeck's novel, The Red Pony. Like that, everything always has a literary bent, you know, in my books, like including Walt's office, which is an abandoned Carnegie Library, and Henry's no different. Like he's a remarkable individual, and I based him off of a good friend of mine up on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation, a fellow by the name of Marcus Red Thunder. And you know, for me, you know, that was another piece of advice that I got, you know, was that you know, write what you know and everything. But you know, I took that one a little to heart, simply because, you know, the Northern Cheyenne and the Crow Reservation are just to the north of where my ranch is. They're on the border of Wyoming and Montana, and they're remarkable people. They're incredible people. And, you know, to leave Indians out of a contemporary Western novel just, you know, didn't ring true to me.
In this book, Walt seems to be having some spiritual experiences that he's quite unprepared for. What made you pursue this storyline?
You know, Walt is not the most spiritual individual. He's a kind of an empirical data kind of guy. He likes to see things that are tangible, feel things that are tangible, and make, you know, adjustments and lines of thought, you know, that are tangible. And so he's not very given, you know, to the spiritual world, you know. But, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, there's that great quote from Shakespeare: "There are greater things, Horatio, than are dreamt of in thy philosophies." And a lot of time, Henry is, you know, the one that's kind of the conduit to allow him to understand some of the spirituality and the things that are happening to him.
I'm gleaning from this interview that you are actually a literature classicist. Is that in your background too?
I guess to an extent it is. Like, I mean, my education was in writing. Like, I've always been a lifelong reader. You know, I grew up in one of those houses that had, you know, stacks of books everywhere. And I remember, you know, when I started the series, you know, with Walt, I wrote the first two chapters of The Cold Dish, and I just really wasn't satisfied, you know, with the character. He seemed a little stereotypical. He seemed a little cliched. And I thought, well, you know, how can I, you know, give him some, you know, some abilities that would be a little bit, you know, above the, you know, the norm. And I didn't want to make him, you know, the usual protagonist in crime fiction, which is the 6'2" of twisted steel and sex appeal. Every woman wanted him. Every man feared him. He could kill anyone with a number 2 Ticonderoga pencil in 3.2 seconds, which is my least favorite character in literature and cinema. And so I thought, well, okay, if he is over, he's a little overweight, a little over, you know, age, a little overly depressed, you know, what are the things that I can give him that will give him a real advantage? And so I thought, you know what, have him read. Have him read. You know, I think one of the sadnesses of Walt's life is he probably would have been happier being, you know, a liberal arts, you know, English, you know, teacher somewhere in some little college somewhere. But Vietnam took a hand, and he became a military policeman. He got home, he got married, he had a kid, and, you know, the only job open in Absaroka County was a deputy. Like, and so he took that job, and that was the path that he went on.
I'm assuming that you're already working on the next one.
I'm actually on chapter 15. I think I've got only like 2 chapters in the epilogue before I'll be finished with next year's book. I like Walt's company. I enjoy his company, so I tend to, you know, write hard.
Well, so do your millions of readers. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, well, thank you. My pleasure. Absolutely my pleasure.
Thanks, Craig.
You bet.
Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
And now let's listen to a sampling of Dry Bones, performed by George Guidall.
When she'd been 6, her father had brought her to this country from Tucson, Arizona, and had dragged her along on his private excavations that helped support his rock shop on the old highway out near Lake De Smet between Durant and Sheridan. She still remembered what she'd said one day as they'd gotten out of his battered pickup, her fingers climbing up his pant leg until she found the reassuring hand with gloves worn like saddle leather, the adjustment straps with the transparent red beads. "There's nothing out here, Daddy." He surveyed the rolling hills that led from the Bighorn Mountains to the endless Powder River country, smiled as he pushed back his straw hat, and spoke gently to her. "There's everything here. You just have to know where to look." Jennifer had learned to look and had never stopped. Dave Bauman's hands and hers were in the excavations that had led to the displays that crowded the High Plains Dinosaur Museum in Durant, and at 26, she was still searching. Truth be told, Jen liked dead things better than live ones. They were less trouble, the conversations being one-sided. A lot of investigators and paleontologists are more comfortable that way, able to accept the consensus of truth, disregarding the absolute as something that always carries the danger of being overturned by some new and extraordinary piece of evidence. She lowered the camera, took another sip of water, and poured her dog more. Brody sighed and shook his massive head, and Jen leaned back under the rock overhang to try to decide what she was going to do with the old man's rock shop, a ramshackle affair near the lake that had started out as a trailer but through the years had evolved into a labyrinth of wooden fences lined with geodes, gems, quartz, and rock samples, most of them worthless. He had died the year before, and she knew the land was more valuable than the structure itself, but she'd grown up there and loved the old place, as cluttered and tacky as it might be. She pulled the cap over her eyes and dozed until she became aware of a protracted growl in her dog's throat. She swatted at him, but he continued to rumble a warning until she finally lifted the bill of her cap to look at him. He was looking directly up. Jen's eyes followed to where a 2-fingered talon stretched out of the rock ceiling down toward her, almost as if it were imploring. She grabbed the camera and began to film what would become one of the greatest paleontological discoveries in modern times. Victoria Moretti sipped the coffee from the chrome lid of my thermos, leaned forward, and peering through the windshield, watched the man with an intensity that only her tarnished gold eyes could command. "Is that some weird Wyoming fishing technique I don't know about?" I could see that Omar was tossing something into the water from the banks of the man-made reservoir. "What the hell is he doing?" Ruby, my dispatcher, had received a call from him early in the morning and had bushwhacked Dog and me with it when we came in the door. I'd filled up my thermos and in turn bushwhacked Vic before heading out to the 10,000-acre Lone Elk place to find out what was up. Outdoor adventurer, outfitter, and big-game bon vivant, Omar Rhodes had contracts with all the big ranchers and sometimes used their property for extended hunting and fishing junkets. Usually he kept his spot secret, but this time he'd told Ruby where he was and that I might want to come out and meet him. Most everything was in bloom in late May, and I breathed in the scents from the open windows of my truck. As I stared at the aspens and cottonwood, they all began stretching to the sky like those cypresses in Italy that looked like thumb smudges. My undersheriff turned and looked at me some more. I thought he was in China. Mongolia. The Custer lookalike was dressed in a state-of-the-art fishing vest, waders, and his ever-present black cowboy hat with more flies stuck in it than Orvis has in its catalog.
That was Dry Bones by Craig Johnson. And of course, since this is a Dad's Day salute, we should cover a new and notable title in sports. If Dad's a baseball fan, consider Charles Lairson's Ty Cobb, a terrible beauty. Cobb was baseball royalty. Some call him the greatest player who ever lived. When he retired in 1928, after 21 years with the Detroit Tigers and two with the Philadelphia Athletics, he held more than 90 records. But the numbers don't tell half of Cobb's tale. The Georgia Peach was the most thrilling player of the era. When the Hall of Fame began in 1936, he was the first player voted in. But Cobb was also one of the game's most controversial characters. He got in fights on and off the field and was often accused of being overly aggressive. In his day, even his supporters acknowledged that he was a fierce and fiery competitor. His philosophy was to create a mental hazard for the other man, so he had his enemies. After his death in 1961, something strange happened. His reputation morphed into that of a monster, a racist who also hated children and women, and was in turn hated by his peers. How did this happen? Who was the real Ty Cobb? Setting the record straight, Charles Lairson pushes aside the myths, traveling to Georgia and Detroit to retrace Cobb's journey from the shy son of a professor and state senator who was himself a progressive on race, to America's first true sports celebrity. In the process, he tells of a man who cut his own path through his times. Malcolm Hilgartner performs the book.
The paternal side of Ty Cobb's family tree can be traced ultimately to Ireland, but it has deep roots in America and many tangled branches. One section, known within the clan as the Georgia Cobbs, produced Howell Cobb, Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Secretary of the Treasury under James Buchanan, and governor of his state, as well as his younger brother Thomas Reed Roots Cobb, a Confederate major general. But William Herschel Cobb descended directly from a different and fairly distant line, which ran back into the hills of North Carolina. His people were more iconoclastic than their fancy Georgia kin, especially regarding the peculiar institution. W.H.'s grandfather, William Alfred Cobb, was a Methodist minister who tested the patience of his parishioners by preaching to Indians and whites alike, then pushed the congregation around the bend by preaching against slavery. In 1848, he and his family were run out of Haywood County for their abolitionist beliefs. They resettled in Union County, a more mountainous region where slaves, being less vital to the economy, were not such a hot-button issue. The one child of William A. Cobb whom we know much about, John Franklin Cobb, Ty's beloved Grandpa Johnny, was an anti-slavery Republican who joined Robert E. Lee's army when his state seceded, but failed to consistently report for duty. He seems to have exuded a palpable air of intelligence, a certain oracular presence, which conveyed to his Cherokee County neighbors that he was a man of principle, a conscientious objector rather than a common deserter. Indeed, by his middle years, John had become known as Squire Cobb for his service as an all-purpose sage and adjudicator of local disputes. Although not an educated man, he strongly believed in book learning and made sure all four of his sons and both of his daughters went to college, at least for a while, an amazing feat of 19th-century parenting. His firstborn, Ty's father, W.H., got the furthest in school, taking a B.A. in liberal arts in 1892 from North Georgia Agricultural College in Dahlonega, the first coeducational college in the state. Although he was already a married man with three children and a full-time teaching job, W.H. graduated first in his class. In an unpublished family memoir, Ty's Aunt Nora remembered that as her older brother W.H. received his diploma, she felt her mother's tears splash upon her hand and saw her father run his finger around his collar to give the lump in his throat more room to dissolve. Amanda, wearing white satin with filmy lace like moonbeams around her neck, waited stage right to present her husband, whom she would shoot and kill one day, with a bouquet of budded roses. 6-year-old Ty, she said, slept through the ceremony. Ty Cobb's father was ambitious in the modern way, eager to better himself through education and willing to relocate. He was also religious in the modern way, which is to say, not terribly. Royston in general was not known as a particularly pious place. Although seeming unable to turn down any job involving blackboards and desks, he did serve as superintendent of the Baptist Sunday School. Like many in the post-war generation who took part in the Great Migration from family farm to city or town, he felt, well, a bit disoriented, no doubt, but also liberated from eons of ignorance. Said Cunningham, he lived before his time. W.H. had no interest in singing the same old hymns and making the same old mistakes until he expired in the bed where he'd been delivered. He was especially outspoken about race. History teaches that three systems of controlling the people have been tried: slavery, serfdom, and education, he said before a meeting of the Georgia Agricultural Society in 1901, and that the first two have been dismal failures. Like his father, he saw education as the key to individual and societal progress and disdained Jim Crow brutality. He once turned up in a local hardware store where a small mob had gathered to discuss the lynching of a Negro then in the town jail, reminding them that they lived in a country of laws and that he would personally make sure they answered to those laws if they continued with their plotting. He sent his neighbors home grumbling.
We've just heard Ty Cobb by Charles Learson. They call them the Travelers. They move from city to city, panhandling, committing no crimes. They just like to stay on the move. And now, someone is killing them. In John Sanford's Gathering Prey, Lucas Davenport's adopted daughter, Letty, is home from college when she gets a phone call from a woman traveler she'd befriended in San Francisco. The woman thinks somebody's killing her friends, and she's afraid she knows who it is. Her male companion has just gone missing. She's hiding out now in North Dakota, and she doesn't know what to do. Letty tells Lucas she's going to get her, and though he suspects Letty's getting played, he volunteers to accompany her. When he hears the woman's story, he begins to think there's something to it. In the days to come, Lucas embarks on an odyssey through a subculture unlike any he's seen before, and into a trip that puts him into grave danger. Richard Ferrone narrates.
The young woman who'd been leaning against the fire hydrant ambled up to them. She smiled and nodded to Henry, but spoke to Skye. I don't give money to buskers or panhandlers because I'm afraid they'll spend it on dope. I got better things to do with it. Well, thank you very much, Skye said. Her voice was harsh by smoke, and a good bit of that had been weed. You're a traveler, the woman said, showing no offense. You know about us? Enough to pick you out, the woman said. My name's Letty. What's yours? Skye. My friend is Henry. Skye was calculating. This woman was either with the devil or she could be worked. And Skye was hungry. Let's go up to the park, Henry said. Hang on, Skye said, back to the young woman. If you won't give us money, could you get us a bite? there's a McDonald's a couple blocks from here, Letty said. I'll buy you as much as you can eat. Them's the magic words, Henry said, suddenly enthusiastic, his pink face going even pinker. The two travelers shouldered their packs, and Henry carried his guitar case, and they started down Geary, walking toward Market Street, weaving through the tourists. Where are you coming from, and where are you going? Letty asked. Skye said, We were in Santa Monica for the winter, then we started up here a couple weeks ago. Planning to be here for a couple of weeks, get some money, then go on up to Eugene and maybe Seattle. Henry said to Skye, I could have sworn I saw Pilot go by a few minutes ago. I heard they were traveling this summer. We stay away from that, Skye said. He's the devil. Is not, Henry said. He's cool. He's not cool, Henry. He's a crazy man. Been in movies, man, Henry said. He said he might be able to get me a part. Skye grabbed his shirt sleeve, turning him. Henry, he'll kill you. Henry started walking again, and they could see the McDonald's sign beyond him. He looked back at the two women. You don't know a chance when you see one, Skye. He could get me a part. I'd like to be in a movie. I'd really like that. Why? So you know you're alive? You're alive, Henry. Let's try to keep it that way. Henry shut up, and they got to the McDonald's. Inside, the two travelers loaded up on calories. Henry ordered a double quarter pounder with cheese, large fries, a chocolate shake. Letty said, Get a couple burgers if you want. You serious? Henry asked. Go ahead. They did. Two sandwiches, two fries, and a shake for each of them. Letty got a fish sandwich and a Diet Coke. When they'd spread out at a table, Letty asked Skye, So, you feel safe when you're on the road? Yeah, I'm pretty safe, Skye said. She took a big bite of the first burger and said, I'm usually with somebody, which helps. When I'm alone, getting ready to move, I'll find a festival or something like that where there are a lot of people. You can ask around, find somebody going in your direction, check up on him or her. Sometimes, when I got the money, I'll ride the dog. One time I met this guy in San Antonio. He was a dope dealer, but, you know, he was okay.
That was Gathering Prey by John Sanford. The Book Report brings you another idea for history-loving dads. James Scott's Target Tokyo, Jimmy Doolittle, and the Raid That Avenged Pearl Harbor. In December 1941, as the dead were being tallied at Pearl Harbor, President Roosevelt gathered his senior military counselors to plan a counterstrike against the heart of the Japanese Empire, Tokyo. 4 months later, on April 18, 1942, 16 U.S. Army bombers, under the command of a daredevil pilot, Jimmy Doolittle, lifted off the deck of the USS Hornet on a one-way mission to pummel the enemy's factories, refineries, and dockyards. For Roosevelt, the raid was a propaganda victory. In Japan, outraged over the deaths of innocent civilians, military leaders launched an ill-fated attempt to seize Midway, a battle that would turn the tide of the war. At the center of this story is Doolittle, son of an Alaskan gold prospector, a former boxer, and a brilliant engineer who earned his doctorate from MIT. Here, too, are portraits of the young pilots, navigators, and bombardiers, many of them little more than teenagers, who raised their hand to volunteer for a mission from which few expected to return. Most of the bombers ran out of fuel and crashed. Captured raiders suffered torture and starvation in POW camps. Others faced a harrowing escape across China, with the Japanese army in hot pursuit. based on scores of never-before-published records drawn from archives across four continents, as well as new interviews with survivors. Target Tokyo, performed by L.J. Ganser, is an adventure story and a re-examination of one of America's most daring military operations.
President Franklin Roosevelt was enjoying a late lunch in his White House study Sunday afternoon, December 7, 1941. The 59-year-old three-term president had transformed the parlor off his second-floor bedroom, a room where Thomas Jefferson played his violin and Abraham Lincoln read the Bible, into a cluttered study that reflected his lifelong love of the sea. Model ships ranging from river packets and square riggers to a modern destroyer adorned tables and the fireplace mantel, while Currier and Ives lithographs crowded the ivory walls, depicting life along the Hudson River, whose muddy banks formed the western boundary of Roosevelt's native Hyde Park. A portrait of Revolutionary War naval hero John Paul Jones, rescued from a second-hand shop for $25, kept watch over the president as he worked at his oak desk, crafted from timbers salvaged from the ill-fated Arctic explorer HMS Resolute, an 1880 gift from Queen Victoria to the then-president Rutherford Hayes. With its commanding views of the White House's South Lawn and the Washington Monument in the distance, the Oval Study had become the center of Roosevelt's presidency during his 9 years in power. The wheelchair-bound leader, who had battled polio 2 decades earlier, often preferred the study's convenience to his more formal office downstairs in the executive wing. He not only conducted the nation's business from the comfort of the study's worn leather sofa and chairs, hand-me-downs from Theodore Roosevelt's old presidential yacht, Mayflower, but hosted a 7:15 p.m. cocktail hour for his senior aides, pouring bourbon, old fashions, and martinis on a tray atop his desk, often flavoring them with a dash of absinthe. "He mixed the ingredients with the deliberation of an alchemist," recalled his speechwriter, Robert Sherwood. But with what appeared to be a certain lack of precision, since he carried on a steady conversation while doing it. Roosevelt's Sunday lunch capped a week made stressful by the deteriorating situation in the Pacific, so much so that the president decided to pass on a luncheon hosted by his wife, Eleanor, for 31 people, including his own cousin, Frederick Adams. Instead, he chose to dine in his study at 1:15 p.m. with his longtime friend and trusted aide, Harry Hopkins, before he planned to settle in for a quiet afternoon of work on his treasured stamp collection. Despite the demands he faced as the nation's commander-in-chief, Roosevelt carved out time each week to sort, clip, and affix stamps into more than 100 hand-tooled leather albums. The collection would grow over his lifetime to number 1.2 million stamps, including ones from countries as far-flung as Haiti and Hong Kong, and even a few of the last 20-cent Confederate stamps believed ever sold at a postal station. Roosevelt's boyhood hobby had over the years evolved into a form of occupational therapy, which the president needed now more than ever. Roosevelt had long struggled to prepare the American public and lawmakers for war, many of whom argued that the vast Atlantic and Pacific Oceans served as natural barriers against foreign aggressors. He focused much of his attention on Europe. Adolf Hitler's Germany had invaded Poland in September 1939. Denmark and Norway soon fell, followed by the Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg, and France. Hitler unleashed his bombers on Great Britain in September 1940 in an 8-month assault known as the Blitz that killed 43,000 and left another 1.4 million homeless. Roosevelt had watched the destruction with horror and an eye toward the future. The broad expanse of the oceans, he warned, was not the same as in the days of clipper ships. America's best hope to remain on the sidelines was to arm friendly nations now at war. "No man can tame a tiger into a kitten by stroking it," he declared in a December 1940 fireside chat. "We must be the great arsenal of democracy." Much to the frustration of the president, who hoped to forestall a fight in the Pacific, Japan had continued on a collision course with the United States, triggered in part by unique social and geographical challenges.
That was Target Tokyo by James M. Scott. close today's Salute to Dads with a title that was one of last year's Audio Publishers Audi Award finalists for humor. No one writes about family quite like Drew McGarry. The GQ correspondent and Deadspin columnist has hilarious stories about trying to raise a family. In Someone Could Get Hurt, he's brought that unique voice to a memoir. Drew, who performs the book, reflects on his own parenting to explore the anxiety, rationalizations, compromises, and overpowering love that comes with raising kids. In brutally honest and funny stories, McGarry reveals how American parents cope with being in over their heads and how stepping back can sometimes make all the difference. It's a celebration of all the surprises, joyful and otherwise, that come with being part of a real family. The author performs this story of head lice, almost dirty words, flathead syndrome, and the tale of a man trying to commit the ultimate act of selflessness in a selfish world.
I'd never heard the term Dusky Bowels before. It sounded like a good name for a fantasy football team. The doctor needed our consent before going ahead with the surgery. We didn't hesitate for an instant. In fact, we felt as if we had wasted enough of his time already. It's amazing how quickly you'll agree to a procedure like this once you hear talk of survival rates. You take a leap of faith. You trust that a total stranger will know how to properly disembowel your child because you do not. He was a nice-looking doctor. He seemed to know what he was talking about. I signed the forms. The doctor rushed back into the operating room to prepare, and a very nice NICU nurse named Kathy led my wife and me to our son, to see him one final time before he went to have his guts torn out. They had knocked him out with an anesthetic, so he was sleeping peacefully by the time we got there. He was in an isolate and had wires running from his mouth, chest, stomach, and foot. He looked like an IED. He was surrounded by a phalanx of adults who were all determined to prevent his death because the death of a child is the saddest thing in the world. He wasn't old enough or awake enough to know that he didn't want to die. We did all that worrying for him. Kathy opened the top of the isolate so we could kiss him on the head. Possibly for the last time. Possibly just another kiss in an entire lifetime of them. His head was coated with a shocking mass of black hair. When a baby is born premature, it still has plenty of the mother's hormones racing through its system. This can cause it to have enlarged genitals, lactating breasts, or a healthy head of hair. That hair eventually falls out and is replaced with new hair, but for now, our son still had hair long enough to get a side gig as a bassist. I bent down and let my nose glide along the soft fur, alternating between taking in his scent and kissing him on the head. I wanted to retain as much of the sensation as I could. Kathy led my wife and me back out to the general surgical waiting room. They had updates on the status, all the operations, listed on a big monitor at the far end of the room. We could check our son's intestines like we were trying to catch a connecting flight to Milwaukee. The second I saw my son's doctor and room number up on the board, I got a morbid thrill. There's my boy up on the TV! Then reality set back in and I could feel my heart withering. There were dozens of other people sitting in the room and I felt exposed, naked, without any armor to protect myself. I just wanted to find somewhere for my wife and me to cry ourselves sick. Kathy saw us visibly breaking down in front of everyone and stole us into a private waiting room. I sat down next to my wife and stared off into space because the rest of the world seemed empty to me at that moment. Desolate. We took turns telling each other it was going to be okay because it helps in times of grief, and someone you love tells you everything's going to be all right, even when you suspect it's a lie. All I could think about was my son dying. I tried my best to avoid it, but I couldn't. I wondered what would happen if his intestines were deemed unsalvageable. Do they euthanize your child? Do they just leave him until he starves to death because he can't fully digest anything? They can't do that. The world couldn't possibly be that cruel, could it? I envisioned being escorted into the morgue and holding a swaddled 9-day-old corpse in my hands, and how that would make me feel. He wasn't dead yet. I had a clear idea of how badly it would hurt. My heart was firmly clenched to absorb the blow. I thought about whether we'd have a funeral for him. I didn't think we would, because that would be just too awful to put our friends and family through. You can't herd people into a room and force them to stare at a tiny coffin for an hour. I wondered if he could donate his organs as a premature infant. I wondered if we would bury him or cremate him, and where we might scatter his ashes. Maybe the Atlantic Ocean. He might like that. Maybe we would get a dog if he passed away. A little dog named Otis or Kirby that would bark and yip and all over the place and help us forget about this. That might help. Maybe nothing would help. Maybe our marriage wouldn't survive if he died. We'd been married 9 years, together for 12. I remember the night we met in some shitty Manhattan bar that no longer exists. I staggered out of the John, and there she was, drunk and smiling, as if she had been planted there by some magnificent benefactor. It took 5 minutes for me to get her full name right, because it was an obscure Armenian name, and I was too shitty to pronounce obscure Armenian names. God, I loved her. Only an act of extraordinary circumstances could possibly end us. A war, a natural disaster, an unspeakable crime, etc. And as we waited, I thought, perhaps these were those extraordinary circumstances. Maybe we would look at each other after this and see nothing more than a reminder of what was lost. Maybe we would drift apart, and I would become a filthy hobo, working odd jobs and dabbling in surfing and heroin.
We've just heard Someone Could Get Hurt by Drew McGarry. Readers, Dad is a multidimensional guy, and so are the books we've previewed today. If we haven't covered topics of Dad's special interest, be sure to check my website, bookreportradio.com, for ideas he's sure to like. Thanks so much for joining me today. So this weekend, let Dad know how much he means and enjoy your Father's Day. Then, let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.